The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. This week in The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, I'm Kevin McCullough. It's great to be with you. After the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the nation prepares for another confirmation battle.
This moment and this chapter that we're in the country is kind of a gladiator match for the future of America.
We'll look at the profound and fundamental reasons why it's so tense.
You're looking at two different ways of understanding the Constitution.
And the role of the late Justice Ginsburg in the fight for life.
We believe in life from conception to grave, and fundamentally we saw it differently. And she saw it, obviously, as an equality issue.
Plus, Franklin Graham heads to the nation's capital for prayer.
We're going to pray and ask for God's help and restore this nation.
We've got all this and more. I'm Kevin McCullough, your host, coming to you from my home stations in New York City. You can hear my program live each weekday afternoon on AM 570 and FM 102.3 The Mission, or on AM 970 The Answer. Take a moment to follow me and The Christian Outlook on Twitter, my handle at KMC Radio, and The Christian Outlook at TC Outlook. Great to be with you. If you thought that 2020 could not get any stranger or could not handle yet another major news event, you'd be wrong. A week ago Friday, September the 18th, we were met with the word that Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died at the age of 87. In one sense, it was not a huge surprise. The justice had fought several bouts of cancer and was hospitalized earlier this year. In another sense, it was really huge. For a closer look, let's turn to Charlie Kirk of Turning Point USA, and coming October 5th, a colleague of mine with Salem Radio. He was a guest of Eric Metaxas.
With the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, obviously it sets up something that nobody really anticipated, or maybe people who knew she was going to pass anticipated it, but most Americans didn't. We have a moment where the president, he's made it very clear that he means to nominate someone and have the Senate approve that someone. And it sets up a political battle where I believe the left is going to pull out all the stops, which is never pretty. What do you suppose is going to happen?
Look, no one asked for this. This was not something that Republicans had in the cards. However, there's a couple points on this. Number one, this election is absolutely going to be going to the courts. We know that. Joe Biden has 600 attorneys on staff. Joe Biden has a plan to litigate this election for weeks on end. Hillary Clinton said that Joe Biden should not concede under any circumstances at all whatsoever. We saw Bush versus Gore go all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, and that was 40 days of us waiting for a winner to be officially announced, with Gore still refusing to concede up until the very last moment. That scenario is not just likely, it's probable that is going to happen this November. If you have a Supreme Court where it is only 8 members, you could conceivably have a tie in the Supreme Court. That would be incredibly irresponsible to leave that seat open. So I believe that the Senate Republicans should confirm this justice immediately. And the fact that the Democrats are now saying they might impeach the president, they might pack the courts, good. That's your negotiating position, that you're going to blow up the country because you're out of power? Then fine. Show the American people that. I don't deal with extortionists, nor should Senate Republicans. I think the more that the Democrats threaten, the more we should lean into it.
I think you're right. In a way, it's funny because what Trump has done consistently, I think partially he does it intentionally, but partially I simply think it's who he is. He drives his opponents loco. I've never seen anything like it, and I find it very funny. He's like the guy that, you know, somebody sees a scary hornet's nest and they say, we better walk this way because, like, that there's a lot of hornets in that nest. You don't want to make them angry. He would get a stick, walk over to the nest, and beat it until he's stung a few times and then run away. Like, that to me is what happens. And it strikes me that the Kavanaugh situation, if that hadn't been so despicably run by the Democrats, you know, I think that there would be a little room for civility. But it seems like now you understand this is a scorched earth policy on their side, no matter what we do. So we better get busy.
Yeah, and this is a really important point, Eric, where the left wants power out of this. They're talking about packing the courts. We actually want balance. It's a very different thing. The reason why conservatives want this seat filled is we actually want someone who just interprets the Constitution. We want a balance. We want a check. I have another argument that I think we need to make. Now that the left is threatening America, like in a sort of a hostage situation, if you do this, we're going to start metaphorically shooting prisoners, basically is what they're saying, right? I mean, this is no different than the Iranian hostage situation, metaphorically, where they think they have power over us. You cannot reward that. The minute that they say that they're going to pack the court, you better believe we're going to fill the seat now. The fact that your position is if we don't do this, you then validate that sort of tactics. You validate their ridiculous anti-constitutional stance. So in my opinion, now that their position is we're going to blow up the country, now we have a moral obligation to fill the seat, or else you play into them, because they'll always go back to that as a way to stop it when they see things they don't like.
Trump is the kind of president, I think, who would do what you just said, who would say, we're not going to play that game. And in fact, we have to set a standard. We have to set a precedent and be clear here that we're not going to allow the other side to bully us that way. No one has said that until you just did now. But I think that that's actually really, really sharp thinking. And I hope that he sees it that way.
Yeah. And that's people say, well, I want to see us get back to unity and back to civility in the country. And I completely agree. However, this moment and this chapter that we're in the country is kind of a gladiator match for the future of America. And we have a street fighter from Queens who knows how to fight. There is now an open Supreme Court seat. I didn't ask for it. You didn't ask for it. You know, she died unexpectedly right before an election, where we now have the mail-in ballots and the Democrats saying they're going to blow up America. So fill the seat.
The explanation behind what Charlie Kirk calls a gladiator match for the future of America is a fundamentally different approach to the role of the Supreme Court in our great nation. Dr. Albert Mohler explained from his briefing program.
When you look at the Supreme Court and the 9 seats on the Supreme Court, a Chief Justice and 8 Associate Justices of the United States Supreme Court, every one of those justices appointed to a life term, you are looking at the fact that for the last 50 to 60 years, there has been a very deep divide. Now, that divide's older than that in one sense, but there has been no denying it for the last half century. You're looking at 2 different ways of understanding the Constitution. You're looking at 2 different kinds of judges who end up sitting on the nation's highest court. You're looking at 2 different visions of text, even of reality and of the future of the United States. On an issue like abortion, you're looking at the fact that there are some judges who look to the Constitution and rightly say, there is no reference here to abortion whatsoever, much less to any kind of constitutional right to an abortion. On the other hand, you have justices who have been winning the case in so many cases, going back to Roe v. Wade in 1973, arguing that it is proper now to see the Constitution as a living document in which rights can be found, basically newly invented, that the nation's just going to have to live with. And thus the cultural left and the cultural right have been deeply divided over the Supreme Court. But when it comes to those particular seats, only rarely has there been an opportunity for a president to nominate a justice that would fundamentally change the composition of the court. Right now, if President Donald Trump, a Republican president, nominates a conservative justice to the Supreme Court who is confirmed by the present Republican majority in the United States Senate, that will mean a conservative justice sitting where a liberal justice had sat for 3 decades almost. And so you're looking at a fundamental change in the court. And both sides understand it. That's why Democrats and liberals are so upset. And that is why conservatives and Republicans see an opportunity they cannot, in the face of history and in the face of Republican voters, fail to fulfill. After the initial shock of the weekend, it's really interesting to see where the nation's cultural conversation is turning. For example, Linda Hirschman wrote an article published in the Washington Post with the headline, "Ruth Bader Ginsburg Had a Vision for America. Her colleagues thwarted it." Hirschman argues that as you look to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you see a justice who had such a progressivist, liberal vision for America, it could only be thwarted by those on her own side, that is, on her own team, so to speak, fellow Democratic nominees to the court, who would fail to move in the kind of direction that she had hoped for. Now, folks, this is where we are as a country. The left has been in control of the Supreme Court for so long, the left is in absolute panic over the idea that there might be a stable conservative majority in a future court. Now, the Federalist Society is made up largely of law school students and graduates who are now involved in the law as attorneys or as judges, law professors also, who are committed to a strict constructionist and originalist or textualist interpretation of the Constitution. Now, in any previous century in American history, you wouldn't have had to use those terms because it would have meant reading the Constitution as the Constitution, reading it in terms of its words and sentences and the intention of the original authors. But nowadays, this is up against the liberal progressivist understanding of the Constitution as a living document in which judges can effectively make it say whatever they want it to say. That's the deep divide between the right and the left on the nation's highest court. But there's something more here. It's a threat. The threat in the subhead of this New York Times article is that if Republicans should successfully confirm any kind of conservative to that seat, then Democrats in response need to pack the court, to expand the number of seats on the court, in this case to 13. Why the magic number 13? Because this would be four additional seats, meaning that if a Democratic president made those nominations and a Democratic Senate confirmed them, there would be an overwhelming, indeed nearly invincible, liberal majority on the court. Now, where does court packing come from? Well, actually, the phrase goes back to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Not that he used it, it was used of him. President Roosevelt sought to expand the number of seats on the Supreme Court because he was frustrated that the court then was not moving fast enough to allow his New Deal legislation to go through. And thus, he made the effort to expand the number of seats in the court so that he could appoint the justices to those new seats who would move the court along. Effectively, if he couldn't persuade the judges, he would just add new judges. But what we're witnessing here is basically a threat to the constitutional order, and that was understood even by Franklin Delano Roosevelt's own party.
Coming up, Justice Ginsburg and abortion.
We believe in life from conception to grave, and fundamentally we saw it differently. And she saw it, obviously, as an equality issue. But I always would ask myself, you know, what about the woman in the womb? What about equality for that female baby?
Jim Daly, A Focus on the Family, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. For all those who are concerned about issues of life and are engaged in the pro-life movement, you are well aware that since 1973 and Roe v. Wade, the nation's highest court has taken the issue out of the hands of voters and has, for all practical purposes, been the defender of abortion on demand. Justice Ginsburg was very much at the center of this debate during her 27 years on the court. Jim Daly, A Focus on the Family, was a guest on my program. You know, I don't know about you, but my phone at about 7:49:50 on Friday night just melted. And, of course, I logged into Twitter to great dismay and saw what was immediately turning into the ugliest place on planet Earth. But it is a very significant thing that has happened with the passing of Justice Ginsburg. You had a major group that deals with family-related public policy and family issues. Focus on the Family, if you're unfamiliar with Jim's title. He's the CEO and president of that organization, originally founded by James Dobson many years ago. But you guys are focused on the life issue. You're focused on some of the things that Ginsburg has weighed in on over the years. And I'm just curious your reaction to where the nation's at following her passing.
Well, you know, it's an interesting moment, and the timing is quite interesting to me as well, whether coincidental or God incident, who knows. But, you know, the first thought I had, Kevin, when I got the news that the justice had passed away is, you know, whether you're left, right, or center, as Christians, we believe that the Lord is obviously the one who holds all truth. And I can't imagine what that would be like to be a Supreme Court judge, you know, consequential decisions over decades, and then you stand in front of the provider of all truth, the judge of judges, you might say, not in a negative way, but what an amazing moment. And, you know, certainly our hearts are heavy that we lost a great American, and she did much to help women, and I get that. The biggest issue we would have is that support for abortion, because we believe in life from conception to grave, and fundamentally we just saw it differently. And she saw it, obviously, as an equality issue. But I always would ask myself, you know, what about the woman in the womb? What about equality for that female baby? And I never really got a good answer from anyone. So the initial reaction is it's heavy, but at the same time, it opens the door for hopefully President Trump to be able to place someone in there who's a true originalist, someone who doesn't interpret the law or make law, but will just go by the Constitution to determine whether it's constitutional or not, these laws that the Congress passes.
That's what he has pledged to do. He has kept that promise for 3.5 years, and we have seen some progress on the life issue as a result of that, Jim. And I know that, as you made mention, Focus has cared strongly about the abortion issue since the legalization of it in 1973. This week, you've got a big event, Sea Life 2020. Perhaps people have heard some about it. For people that haven't, what is it?
Well, we're going to build on what we did in New York last year in 2019 when we held that event in Times Square, which was incredible. We had 20,000 people join us. We had about 400 protesters. We had great speakers and some great music. And then we showed the star of the program was a 4D ultrasound of a third trimester baby. And it all went reasonably flawless.
And can I just add that the star of the whole thing was the when that ultrasound picture hit the screen, the silence that fell over time. Jim, I was standing not far from you. The silence that fell across all of Times Square. I've never heard Times Square be silent.
And the fact that it
went deafeningly quiet for those few moments it was remarkable.
That heartbeat, you know, wafting through the air through Times Square, the beep, beep, ba-boom, ba-boom, and then the baby's face coming to the screens. It was great.
From the vacancy on the Supreme Court to the pandemic to our civil unrest and, of course, our upcoming election, one thing is very clear. Our nation needs prayer. And prayer is what Franklin Graham is calling the nation to in this weekend's Washington Prayer March 2020. Graham was a guest of Don Crow on WAVA in Washington, D.C.
In all the years, now I read you over 30 years, you've been preaching the gospel all over the world, all over the nation. Why do you see this as such an important time, maybe the most important our country's ever faced?
Because our country is facing the possibility of a socialist government. And we see what socialism did in Eastern Europe and how it went after the churches and closed churches, where the pastors were even put in prison for whatever reason that the socialists came up with. And socialism is not the friend of people of faith. And this is a very dangerous time for us. And socialists believe that the government is God and that everything is owed to the government and not to the individual. And they certainly take God out of everything. And we are facing now the possibility of a socialist government. And I just think the only hope for this country is God. This cannot be solved by Democrats or Republicans or independents, only God can solve it. And I think if we call out to him and ask him for help, that he will give that to us. But this country is changing so quickly. We've taken God out of schools, education. We've taken him out of government, and the country is not getting better. It's getting worse. We don't need less of God. We need more of God. And that's something that I feel very strongly about. And I hope the church will wake up and see what's happening. And so many churches have stayed on the sidelines, and they feel that they can't speak out. You know, 100 years ago, the churches were the political leaders in a community. They're the ones who gave the political direction. And the government has been able to shut the mouths of the churches, and it's just a shame as what happened. And I'm hoping people will just pray and join me on this coming Saturday. They're on the mall at 12 noon at the Lincoln Memorial, and we're going to call on the name of God, and we're going to march across the mall all the way to the Capitol, praying as we go, stopping at different locations. But we're going to pray and ask for God's help and restore this nation.
And if there are those, and there are in this country, I'm sure, who think, well, that's a little extreme, Reverend, to take that analysis. I'm not one of those, of course, nor many of our listeners are not either. But we do already have a soft socialism that is moving in. I, again, today was reading an update of one of you, I'm sure a good friend of yours, Dr. John MacArthur's situation, who would have imagined that one of the most outstanding theologians and pastors in our country is now seriously considering that he may have to go to prison. And he has said, if that's what it comes to, I will go there. And it seems like that may well happen unless there's a reversal of course. So that really is symptomatic, isn't it?
Well, who would have ever thought that just a few months ago or a few years ago that the government could instruct the churches to shut down? The government has no authority to intervene in the way we worship and how we want to worship. That's very clear in the Constitution, but the socialists just disregard the Constitution. They want to rewrite the Constitution, do away with the First and Second Amendment. That is the plan that they have for America, and they're very close to getting that. And this election's extremely important, because if America, if we lose our freedom, then the freedom of that so many countries around the world where America has protected them, they could possibly lose theirs too.
Coming up, a new chapter for Israel in the Middle East.
Imagine if we had Palestinians together with Israelis in the startup environment that Israel's developed, in this high-tech environment that Israel has developed. Their standard of living could take off. Their futures could look much brighter.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Kevin McCullough. For decades now, we've watched Israel's tense relations in the Middle East. And we've been told nothing will happen with the broader Middle East until Israel settles its affairs with her Palestinian neighbors. President Trump and his team took a different approach, and the results have astounded all those who were willing to take a look. David Brog, author and former director of Christians United for Israel, explained in a conversation with Don Crow.
Walk us through all of these efforts of the past to achieve peace and why they did not succeed.
Basically, you know, I think someone coming in from the outside might say, hey, David, you're being too harsh. You know, there's a conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. Whenever there's a conflict, both sides are a little bit to blame. So, you know, maybe the Palestinians could have done better, but Israel could have done better. Why are you blaming the Palestinians? And long story short, I have reluctantly come to become a critic of the Palestinian leadership, I would add, not the Palestinian people. I know some wonderful Palestinians who want peace every bit as much as I do. The leadership, however, has been different. And this has been demonstrated over five principal occasions, five times when the Jews of the region, later the Israelis, offered to share the land with the Arabs of the region, later called Palestinians. And the five times the Palestinian leadership said, no, we don't want to compromise, we want it all. 1937, 1947, 1967, 2000, and 2008. The Jews of the region, the Israelis, basically said, look, we this is our homeland. This is the eternal homeland of the Jewish people, where we were born, where we developed, where we wrote the Bible, and the place we've prayed to come back to ever since the Romans exiled part of our people. But other people live here. Arabs have come to live here in the intervening centuries. We should compromise with them. We should share it with them. In 1937, they offered them 70% of the land. 70%. Each time, the Arabs of Palestine, later the Palestinians, subject to, I would say, a very short-sighted leadership, said, no, we don't want to share it with you. You have no rights here. You have no claims here. We want it all. Each time the Palestinians rejected an offer of 70% or 50% or later what became the rubric under the Clinton parameters, all of the West Bank and Gaza, each time the Palestinians rejected a peace offer, people suffered. Often it was the Israelis who suffered. They had tremendous losses in the 48 War of Independence. They had tremendous losses in the Second Intifada of 2000. But I'll tell you who else has suffered because of these decisions made, the rejectionism of the Palestinian leadership, and that's the Palestinian people. They have suffered because of their bad leaders, not the first time in history, not the last time in history. But I'll tell you what, under this new model, under this Trump model, where we're taking the veto out of the hands of this Palestinian leadership, I have great hopes for the region. But I also have great hopes for the Palestinian people. Imagine if we had Palestinians together with Israelis in the startup environment that Israel's developed, in this high-tech environment that Israel has developed. Their standard of living could take off. Their futures could look much brighter. And I think that's become more real thanks to this very pragmatic and I think brave approach of the Trump administration.
Talking with David Brog, prolific author of several books I wanted to mention, Standing with Israel, Why Christians Support the Jewish State, In Defense of Faith, the Judeo-Christian Idea and Struggle for Humanity, Reclaiming Israel's History, Roots, Rights, and the Struggle for Peace.
There I try to walk people through Israel's history quickly. That's an action-packed 240 pages. But in the process, I also try to rebut the emerging anti-Israel narrative that's come to dominate our campuses and a lot of the progressive left. A lot of it's based on just falsehoods, just lies. And I try to walk through Israel's history in a way where people who read the book will understand the truth, which so often vindicates Israel. Israel ain't perfect, but Israel has made sincere, repeated efforts for peace and coexistence. Unfortunately, those efforts have not been well received.
Maccabee Task Force, yes. How is it going to be affected and your work with it in light of this change?
Oh, it's tremendous. It's tremendous. So the Maccabee Task Force, MacTaskForce.org, we were created to fight this terrible phenomenon on the college campuses called BDS, a movement to boycott, divest from, and sanction Israel. And the idea of those who run this movement is they lie about Israel. They say Israel is a terrible country, a human rights violator, discriminates against its Arab citizens, which you and I both know is just false. And because Israel is such a horrific country, human rights-loving college students have to boycott Israel and divest from Israel. And the people who run these boycott Israel campaigns insist on non-normalization. In other words, they actually discriminate against Jewish students on campus. They discriminate against any student who supports Israel on campus, Jewish or Christian. When you have Arabs and Israelis making peace, when you have Arabs and Israelis cooperating on critical issues in the Middle East, it just shines a spotlight on these ridiculous students and their refusal to talk to Jews on campus and shows how extreme they are and shows how ridiculous they are.
Coming up,
we are not living for the sake of any kingdom that is building itself here on earth, but we belong to a Redeemer who has purchased our very lives with his blood.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. There is so much happening in our world today, so much to be concerned about, so much that we can worry about, but we ought not to be given over to anxiety, even as we remain fully engaged in the times and the challenges that God has for us. Of course, in Scripture, we are reminded to be anxious for nothing, from Philippians 4. Amy Simpson is the author of the book Anxious, Choosing Faith in a World of Worry. She was a guest of John and Kathy on WORD-FM in Pittsburgh.
Now, listen, if we're going to have lives, Amy, that are marked by peace, love, trust, and joy, we're going to have to live on an island with no media of any kind and to be blissfully ignorant of everything else that's happening in the world.
That would be hard. I think it might help, although, you know, certainly no matter what our circumstances, we will struggle with those things, right? Because part of the root of the issue is always within us. Right. So we unfortunately carry it with us. But there are other ways to pursue lives marked by peace, love, trust, and joy. And, you know, really, because we are forced to live in the real world, it really comes out to what we're living for, you know, and who we're living for. Yes. And ultimately, what makes, you know, what's the object of our worship? And that's where what it really comes down to. We are called to live lives marked by peace, love, trust, and joy, but, you know, we don't have the ability to produce those things within ourselves.
You know, in the old days, it was easy to sort of be in transit with our idolatry. Now, my idolatry is with me 24/7.
I can't get away from it.
I'm sick of it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's so much that's bad and difficult and awful about the circumstances we're in right now as a nation and as humans, right, on this planet. But one of the good things about it, I think, is that God is using, he uses times like this to expose the idolatry in our lives and to show us, to reveal to us what these things really are, that yes, we can so easily miss the true nature of what we're building our lives around because we're moving so quickly and, you know, because it's, they seem to be working for us. And yet when they stop working for us or when we slow down, often God in his mercy will expose those things for what they are.
So you've made a good point that the problem isn't social media. Social media is where it shows up, but the problem is in us, is in people, because the poisonous stuff that comes out on Twitter or on Facebook or whatever comes from the poison that's in a heart first. My question, though, is how do we make decisions about our lives that will result in having peace, love, trust, and joy? Because then maybe social media does enter in.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, even though the problem is not, say, on social media or the problem isn't on, you know, cable news, we still have to make wise decisions about how much we expose ourselves to and how much we place ourselves in a position to have awful things coming out of us, you know, or happening within us. So I think it is wise to recognize where some of the forums that are out there where people are engaged in, you know, non-conversation or saying hateful things or whatever, and make choices around how much of that we expose ourselves to. I think we probably all ought to be spending at least as much time in the scriptures right now as we are on, say, social media or watching the news or whatever. So I think that's one thing. We can all use more time and divert more of our time to time with God and time learning from his word and learning from the wisdom that's been offered to us in what God has given us rather than the you know, quote, wisdom that we find out there. Whether it's on social media or it's on the news or it's just in, you know, the day-to-day conversations that we might have sort of thoughtlessly with people around us.
Amy, of course, you know, since the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, there's been a lot of talk about a new justice. And one of those is a woman of deep faith, Amy Coney Barrett. So, you know, on social media, trending about, you know, her faith and, you know, the kingdom of God and the mystery of faith. And I don't know about you, but I always love it when people who don't have faith try to poke their finger at people who do have faith. Because, you know, when you talk about the mystery of faith or when you talk about the Holy Spirit, it is a mystery and it's so complex. And who has the answers, you know, only to go back to the pages of the scripture?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, the true power to live the way we might say we want to live really doesn't come from us, and it doesn't come from, you know, the a big choice that we make to suddenly change our lives. And then it, you know, it, we end up on a whole new path. We certainly, we make those choices every day, but we do so in inviting the work of the Holy Spirit in us and the Holy Spirit, you know, prompting us and equipping us to take advantage of the opportunities we have to speak truth into these conversations. And yet I think, yeah, we need, I think we all need to grow more comfortable with being countercultural, with being weird to the people around us.
Yeah.
You know, I think that that's going to increasingly be true of us, of people who live by faith, of people who embrace a biblical ethic and morality. And so, yeah, I think we need to become more comfortable with that. And the funny thing is, Jesus gave us every expectation that we should need to live that way, you know, that that the world would not understand us and would, that the wisdom of the world would not would see God's wisdom as foolishness. And we certainly experience that. Doesn't mean that we have to totally withdraw from the world or that we, you know, we just try to make ourselves weird for the sake of being weird.
Right.
But, you know, but becoming comfortable with that idea that we really are not living for the sake of being popular for, you know, with the world around us, and that we are not living for the sake of any kingdom that is building itself here on earth, but that our lives really are 100%. We belong to another kingdom, and we belong to a Redeemer who has purchased our very lives with his blood. You know, what does that mean for us to live according to that?
Yeah, I got excited when you were saying that. I was just reading 1 Corinthians 1 a couple days ago, and I laughed out loud because it's so good. Hey, brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many of you were influential. Not many of you were of noble birth. You know, like, you need to re-acclimate yourself to what you are.
Coming up, the gospel in Iran.
The number of Christians in Iran is without doubt in the order of magnitude of several hundreds of thousands and growing very soon beyond a million Christians.
Bob Burney in the final segment of the Christian Outlook. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. If we are to live with gospel confidence in tense and uncertain times, we do well to look up at the progress of the gospel in other regions around the world, places where we might not expect to see a lot of advance for the Great Commission. We'll close with a look at what's happening in Iran. Bob Burney on WRFD, The Word in Columbus, Ohio.
There is some good news out of Iran. In a recent survey of about 50,000 Iranians over the age of 20, a Netherlands-based secular research group found that 1.5% of respondents identify as Christians. Now, I realize that this is somewhat of a reach statistically, but this is a secular research organization out of the Netherlands. And here is their conclusion. Applied across Iran's population of more than 80 million, the number of Christians in Iran is without doubt in the order of magnitude of several hundreds of thousands and growing very soon beyond a million Christians. And most of them would face the penalty of death if it was discovered that they had converted from Islam to Christianity. Now, this is so important for so many reasons. We keep talking about the importance of the next election, but here is something I learned many, many years ago by a dear friend in ministry. When you evaluate current events, whether it's American news or international news, as Americans, our first response usually is, how will this impact our liberty and our freedom? But the first thing we should be concerned about, how will this impact the gospel? Because that's even more important than our liberty and our freedom. Well, Bob, if we lose our liberty and our freedom, then, well, Christians in China lost their liberty and freedom a long time ago, and yet the church is exploding. Christians in Iran have no religious liberty and freedom at all. And yet Christianity is exploding. If you will put the gospel first and foremost when you interpret history, current events, national events, international events, it will change the way you look at the daily news. Because here's the reality. Oppressive governments cannot stop the gospel. I know how I hope this next election will come out. But guess what? No matter how this next election comes out, the gospel cannot be stopped.
Hear the rest of Bob Burney's look at what is happening in Iran. Go to ChristianOutlook.com. That wraps up this edition of our program. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posehn, Mike Cook, and Alex Garrett, I'm Kevin McCullough. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.